Welcome to The Range on the Believe Network, the number one podcast network for professionals. I'm Ralph Irvin, and today we are joined by a scientist, truly a rocket scientist, and for all intents and purposes, the main genius behind some of the biggest club lines from the past 30 years. He and I have chatted many times, but today we get a much better appreciation for everything he has given to golf and well beyond. This is going to be fun as we are joined by Dr. Benoit Vincent, the former chief technical officer with TaylorMade Golf. And now, well, we'll leave that surprise for later. But doctor, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ralph.
We always start our conversations here on the range with a very simple question. How did golf enter into your life?
As it enters actually as an employee, not as a golfer, which is I was not a golfer when I was hired by Salomon, the French company, who back in the 80s decided to diversify their winter sport activity into a summer sport activity. This French company, Salomon, was based in the Alps and decided that they're going to enter golf as a summer sport. And then said they were hiring engineers after they acquired TaylorMade, the American company, American-based company. They were in California back then. So they were looking for engineers, and they hired me for my mechanical engineering capability, absolutely not for my golf capability, because I never hit a golf club when I joined the company, believe it or not.
Let's take a step back, because you earned your PhD in mechanical engineering at Institut National des Sciences Appliquées in Lyon, and you went to work on jet engines, right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's a long time ago, Ralph. It's correct. I went to a mechanical engineering track. And then at the end of my engineering degree, I decided to stay in one of the labs that was specialized in vibrations. And we were studying the rotate when a jet engine rotates, it generates a lot of vibrations. And, you know, you can brakes, fans and the shaft and all kind of things can break at those speeds. And it's very dangerous, of course. And so we're trying to predict that. So I did my PhD in that lab, and I continued after as a teacher and also as a researcher. And I did that for 2 or 3 years when finally I went to the private sector.
Pardon the pun, but I would imagine that that kind of work would have fueled your mechanical passion. I mean, how do you end up in golf design after that?
Ooh. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the what was really appealing in sport, in sports equipment, it's very challenging to bring equipment to the next level of performance. And then you need to really dig deeply into those behaviors, mechanical behaviors of those pieces of equipment in order to perfect them. And so that's really was what I've done in golf, is to understand deeply how they work in the hand of a golfer and how they react at the impact during the swing. And that was a life challenge to understand and really bring new designs that brought new level of performance to sports equipment in general. I never had a chance to design skis, even a bunch of friends back then in France who were designing bindings and skis. I never touched that area. I only worked into the golf division.
Do you recall your first golf design project?
Oh yeah, very clearly, actually, day one on the work. They said on the job, they said, Benoit, here we go, you're going to design a new shaft for TaylorMade. And that's the reason why you were hired. And we'd like you to participate to the development of the bubble shaft. Back then, we did not know that would be the name. It was just a new shaft. And we call it the new shaft concept. NSC, that was kind of the code name for the shaft. And then it started with a very light grip back then. And then it ended up in, you know, 6 years after I was hired to launch this shaft in actually a bubble shaft in 1995, yeah, in the United States.
Well, and that's probably what a lot of people, as much as TaylorMade was known for having the first metal head, a lot of people got to know them because of that bubble shaft.
Yeah. It was quite a a departure in the industry, because actually when you think about the shaft, was, you know, mainly metals, wood, of course, then metals for a long time. And then the graphite shaft started in the late 70s. I think Aldi Latour Gold is what I do remember, because that was the first shaft I had to benchmark, study, troubleshoot. And then we brought, I would say, something different in the field of golf shaft through the bubble. It was an interesting venture. And then Olazabal won the Masters in 1994 with the first bubble shaft. So for us, that was like a validation of the idea. And that's typically of what TaylorMade was always about, is, hey, when the tour player, the best players in the world, can play our equipment and win with it, of course, that's how we validated equipment.
And in those early days, I mean, we talk about, you started in France and made your way to California. What was that like for you personally? I mean, obviously, professionally, you're going into a hotbed of golf development in that neighborhood. But personally, that's such a massive culture shift.
Yes, it was. It was. And I do remember when my boss back then in 1994 said, Benoit, it was a Friday night. And he said, Benoit, I want you to think over the weekend. I'd love you to relocate to California, because we're going to relocate the research and development department that was developed in France. And then I'd like you to think about it over the weekend. And, you know, it talked to my wife. And I think within a minute, we said, OK, let's go. Let's give it a shot. Back then, the only thing I knew about California as a Frenchman was the Americans Cup. You know, that we were watching on TV those boats, and that's the picture I had of. Of course, we had the cliches through the Hollywood movies, but we knew very little. I went a few times during the years that I worked for Salomon, because the way it was organized, we had the R&D department in France, and we had the sales marketing department in the United States in California. So I did some trip, so I have a bit of idea. But you know, when those business trip, you go from the airport to the office to the restaurant to the airport, then you go back to your country. So you never really visit. But yes, when we arrived here, first I had to learn to speak English. Let's put it this way, and not to stop thinking in French when I was speaking. And then we really enjoyed the. The welcoming of our Carlsbad team. It was a wonderful reunion to put these two teams together, the French engineers and the American marketers, I would call. That's the way the divide was created back then. And we had also manufacturing employees, people who were in charge of manufacturing in the US. So putting all the team together was such a, I think, a great experience for me, rather than the split that we lived for the previous 5 or 6 years of my life.
When you come into the offices there, and as you say, I mean, you really had to build a team of developers and engineers and everything else. I mean, the brand had been around for years, but not in the operation that it would become.
Yeah, that's exactly the major change that happened, to your point. It's the operation. Yeah, the brand was there since the late 70s. I think 78 was the start date, but the team changed over time. And then the organization, of course, it was remarkable for me to start to meet a lot of engineers and, you know, train in the United States. And the difference with me, they were all golfers. I was amazed to say, I want a mechanical engineer that had a golf background. And guess what? They were all single-digit handicap. You had no problem to find people. In France, to find a person with single-digit handicap, I think you had to, you know, fly or drive miles and miles away from where I used to live just to find a handful. Here in the United States, suddenly everybody played golf, and that was wonderful. All people that I hired back then, and who are still at TaylorMade, actually, you know, Todd Beach, Brett Walden, and said, I'm thinking about all these people. They were all remarkably single-digit handicap golfers and brilliant mechanical engineers.
That had to make it more rewarding for them because they're obviously building something not as a scientific project, but as something that they want to use, they want to take to the course. And that has to open your eyes as an engineer to saying, yeah, this, it makes a difference having somebody that actually wants to put the product into play, not just develop it for a consumer.
Yeah, that was for me the next step of TaylorMade. Is I think that maybe that was a part of the lack of success of TaylorMade before that, when we were so detached from the market. We were in France, and it's a small golf market far away from the major one, that is the United States. And then even if we understood with our head, I don't think we understood with our heart what to do. And when we finally came to the United States and met all these passionate golfers, I think the intuition plus the intelligence together really was the real start of the TaylorMade as we know it, connected not only to the market, but connected to the tour players, able to speak their language, understand them in a much deeper way than we could just if it would be a scientific project.
Now, I've talked with Sean Toulon about those early days, and I wonder what the direction, how that changed in terms of, okay, now everyone is on this path. Are we looking at incremental changes at that point, or were you looking at a big monumental discoveries in golf club design?
So if we talk back then and today, I think it's the same spirit. We may have lost 1 year here or two in the past, our path at TaylorMade, and that's when we were a little less successful. But when we were coming back alive and strong, and then when we are today, it's always the same recipe. Is innovation is at core, and that's maybe the mechanical engineering speaking here louder, but also products that are really enjoyed and played by the best player in the world. And that's, you know, the golfers here are playing a major role. Yes, we're here constantly to elevate the level of performance of equipment and for the best players. And so we, if you think about in 2000, you'll ask me the questions you want later on, but in 2000, there was this turn about the small head to titanium head bigger than 300 cc. That was the volume of the head grew massively, pretty much around the year 2000. So that was one key factor. And the second key factor was the face became faster. They deliver more ball speed. And we're talking about like a few miles per hour of ball speed just by making the face flexible. These two things, larger head and flexible faces, delivered a radically new level of performance to golf equipment in 2000. And it, even if previous inventions were made, of course, cavity backs and all, I mean, a lot of things were, but the year 2000 was a significant turn in equipment performance. And in the last 20 years, we built on these revolutions and we added more and more of them that really, really brought the equipment to the next level.
I think about it in terms of golf balls. When the Pro V1 came out, it completely changed the direction of golf ball development. Like it basically made a left turn and it never came back. And I have to imagine that it was kind of the same thing in that with club design, is once you figured out how to make a thinner, faster, more flexible face, everything changed and you could go in a totally different direction.
Yeah, I forgot the turn in golf ball. Yeah, it happens actually, yeah, about the same time. Mm-hmm. When the multi-layer solid golf ball like obsoleted overnight the wound ball. We played, I mean, balls never returned to that old design. And similarly in golf club, I think once we enter the titanium world, that's 2000, every driver were made of titanium. We no longer could make a driver made of steel. We could not make them larger than 270 cc. And then we broke the barrier of volume with titanium, and then we never could return. And what the journey was about for 20 years was to try to save as much material, we thinned those walls of those drivers as much as we could in order to use material where we needed it, mm-hmm. not to create volume, but to generate performance. Movable weight, name it. But the search for weight was a 20-year long search to deliver this new level of innovation.
I've thought, and it's funny, I mean, you talk about the thinning of the walls and the titanium as being a technological leap. To me, the biggest leap that I was aware of was the arrival, the addition of movable weight technology. Can you walk us through how that process began? Because I know that's not a, hey, next year we're coming out with this club. No, this is something that took years to develop.
Yes, it did. It did. The whole dream was, could we tailor the trajectory of a driver, which is, can we make it having a little bit of more left tendency, right tendency, flight a little higher, flight a little lower? If we could tailor the trajectory of a driver, and that would be depending on the need of the golfer, that would be gravy. So we did that on tour. Every day we were putting more weight here, more weight there. But the old technique was lead tape. We know that. We've been seeing that for years. Or that later on, we would inject some epoxy loaded with tungsten, and we would weight the golf club in a certain way to tailor the trajectory of some of those golfers on tour. But that was painful, tedious, expensive, and trial and error. It was a lot of work. We could do that for few players. We could not do that for every golfer in the world. Mm-hmm. And so that was the starting point to say, what we do for the best, we need to be able to figure out a way to do it for every golfer in the world. So that was the mission. Now, it's easy to say, it's hard to do. A lot of patents existed that describe different ways to adjust the weight. But first, you need to have weight available, because we were using back then all our weight just to make a shell, just to make a volume. So when we started to understand how to thin those walls in titanium, make them from 1 millimeter to 0.8, 0.7, so we had 30% of the weight, and now we had 20, 30 grams in hand to do something with it. Now we knew how to save, we need to know how to put them back and exchange them. And I do remember some of those brainstorming in R&D to try to do that, up to when we had that a famous engineer, who is still with TaylorMade, brilliant engineer, who came from the bike industry and say, hey, you know, we have this mechanism that we know how to, you know, attach, detach very easily. And so we imagined that the golfer could change that himself or herself. And he proposed a quick mechanism, a weighting mechanism to attach and to release. And it's based pretty much on lodging a cylinder into a cylindrical opening. And then if you can tighten your little plug into a opening, the friction was strong enough to overcome the impact. And that was the opening, and the rest was history.
I remember a product presentation in Orlando at Bay Hill. And honestly, it was a little bit too much for, I think, some of the assembled media to really grasp onto, because they were more interested and intrigued by the magnetic head cover with the TP model than they actually were with the club tech. I mean, because this was so next level that they didn't quite appreciate how big this was.
I do remember that we introduced that magnetic head cover at that opportunity, yeah, especially on the TP version. It was beautiful. It was finally, you didn't have to fight with a head cover to take it off to reveal your driver. But yeah, it was a revolution. And the proof, you know, I use this word in golf, when you see that it's a long-term tendency. It's easy to create something that lasts for a year or two. And we've done some of those over the years. When we introduce something, we believe it's going to be great. Today, more than 15 years, we know that. So we know it's a need for the golfer. We know it's a technology that is highly valuable. Now, the way we're designing those weights have evolved over the years. From the first generation of movable weight that, as we know, those little cylinder piece, to today, those little rectangle that are sliding in openings, in tracks. So the way we execute that idea is different, but it's still fundamentally the same idea.
I'm going to just go out on a limb and take credit for something that probably was already in development, but I don't care. I'll take credit for it here. Because I remember at that launch talking to you and Tom Olsavsky and suggesting, you know, if you put these weights in the corners of a putter, it would be really stable. And sure enough, 2 years later, the Spider came out. So I'm going to take credit for that one.
We'll give you full credit for that. I'm not sure we'll give you money for it, but you would have to speak to TaylorMade for that. But yeah, to your point, Ralph, is this idea of movable weight is it's a great idea, not only for drivers, but also for fairways. We try to implement it in irons. It's a little more cumbersome. It's difficult. The platform, they're small. It's a small piece of equipment. But in putter, when we have a larger platform, we have more space to implement them. It works. And we know toe balance, you know, putters have been around versus balanced putters forever. So we know that some golfers need some different weighting system for the head. And so it's great that we can adjust the same way putters as we do drivers.
I think about what club design was and club marketing and everything was before R7. I think about it in recent years. Here you had something that was so monumental that you literally went with the same brand for a few years, that you went with R7, R7 425 and R7 460, which is a year later, then the R7 Super Quad, which is a year after that. Like, you actually said, you know what, this is so good, we're going to keep this brand name going as we continue to improve the technology.
Yeah, and there were, yeah, it's true that we kept that idea for a while. And R9, actually, that comes after, was another revolution. We can talk about that or not. But if we stay on the R7, is the first one, we wanted to have four little weights. Of course, in R&D, I thought to have only two to start. It would be easier to design. But I do remember internal battle with with my colleagues. Saying, no, we need to have four, otherwise it won't be a good product. So we debated. So we figured out technically how to launch the first R7 with four movable weights. And so because you have the lodging, the equipment, I mean, the part of the head that needs to welcome those weights, let's call it the infrastructure lodging, if you want to, that was consuming weights in addition to the four weights. So actually, we need a lot of weights to hold them and the weight themselves. So because of that, the first R7 was only 400 cc, and the USGA limit was for 60. So we really want it to deliver a driver movable weight with four weights that was 460 cc. And that's the quest of the R7 line. We fought for 2 or 3 years technically to try to thin those walls of the titanium driver more and more and more from 09, 08, 07 to be able to finally deliver the Super Quad with 460 cc with four movable weights.
And while you're doing all this, you were starting an entire golf ball line, working with Dean Snell on the TP Red and the TP Black.
Wow. Yeah, that's an old memory too. Yeah, we, in parallel to all this effort in the club area, it's true that TaylorMade aspired to also deliver a golf ball. I think that if you want to equip players, the golf ball was a natural one. You use it on every shot. And so I don't think you could be a serious golf brand without understanding the ball and offering something. So I think it was natural for TaylorMade to be in the ball business. Now, it was not easy. That was normal. That was very, very logical to be in this business. It was an adventure. That was one of maybe my toughest professional adventure, because I started the ball division at TaylorMade. When I say I mean I was in charge of the technical development of the ball in 1997. And I think that and Dean Snell was one of the first employees actually that met that who joined the team. And I think we started to be successful 10 to maybe 15 years later in the golf world. It took us, let's call it, 10 to 15 years to figure out how to make a good golf ball. That was a hard journey. And I'm so happy, you have no idea, about the fact that now TaylorMade with the TP5X line of product have finally found its way to deliver a golf ball that many, many, many great golfers rely on and, you know, to win or to play at the highest level. That's for me, the driver, TaylorMade proved that they could make the first best driver. That's how they were created. And then what we did is we continued that journey. In golf ball, it was different. There was nothing when we started to engage there. And then, and finally, I would say 24 years after the start of that journey, I think we're a decent player, more than a decent player. We're a real player in this ball. And there is a real innovation offering in golf ball on the market.
Was it easier to make a golf ball once it changed to being a solid core? Like now, you don't have to worry about all the variables that go into a wound ball. You focus on, let's figure out how to develop a great core and then figure out how to create different layers to go on top of it. In a way, to a layperson like myself, that seems like an easier process than trying to make a great wound ball.
Yeah, you know, the easiness of design or manufacturing, those two words never should go together. There's nothing
easier.
I've learned it the hard way over my years, as every single little change is make your life really hard, especially when you have to make millions of those. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little different than, you know, we sell dozens, but you play with one ball at a time. But just to say something is, you know, the five layers of the new golf balls that that we finally settled on to go on the market with. There's five layers. Each layer needs a full attention. There are different material, different processes. Mm-hmm. The putting them together, making sure they are compatible, they work together. It's complicated. And what happened is, what we discovered is, if we want to have a ball that performs differently from the driver to the wedges along the segment, that just doesn't, you know, behave one way and just linearly evolves. If you want a performance that is adjusting along the set, you really need to have way much more than one layer, because with one layer, you kind of have one performance if you want to. So you need to have, we use the word in technology, we use the word degrees of freedom. I mean, you need to have like 5 degrees, 5 different design components to be able to tailor the performance. And to say simply, as you for example, you want to lower your spin on a driver to maximum your distance. You want to maximize your spins around the green to maximize holding the balls when you do those wet shots. And it takes all these layers to be able to refine the performance of the golf balls, and that's complicated.
I think to the first launch of the Penta ball and getting a 5-layer patent on a golf ball, I think that the true recognition of how great and significant that was is when that patent ultimately runs out, every manufacturer is going to be releasing a 5-layer ball because they can't do it right now. And they're just waiting for that clock to run out because the technology is so crucial.
Yeah, it is correct that we can achieve, we can deliver performance that I would say not any other balls can do with only 3 layers or even 4 layers. That's for sure. This patent war in golf is an interesting one. Because I think I lived with lawyers my whole life. they don't want to give me an honorary degree, but I think I spend a tremendous amount of time, and that's an interesting comment you made here, is as a part of the development of equipment, we're trying to protect our inventions, write patents, own that for 17, 20 years, whatever. And then, and after, yeah, the competition is up, you'd better have moved on the next inventions. Like that, it doesn't matter if your patent's obsolete, you're on the next one, on the next great thing.
I imagine as chief technical officer, overseeing all the people that are geniuses in their own right, making golf club, golf ball designs, that there was a battle below you of who could get ideas to you that you would buy into, that you would be convinced this could be a great golf club, because the competition was fierce to be recognized with development.
It is an industry that has been stable. I mean, there was a little bit of growth during the 2000 years as far as the number of players, I think, in the world. If I remember correctly, it's about 50 to 60 million golfers in the world. And that hasn't changed in the last 30 or 40 years. It's about the same number of golfers.
Not until the last year. Yeah, the last year they've taken off, but yeah.
They took it off, yeah. But the question, we saw that during the Tigers years initially. We saw also some peak, I would say 5 or 8 million more golfers came, but they left within a decade and we came back. So we see over the years, over the decades, we see peaks here and there. But overall, when you leverage the whole, you know, 30, 40 years, it's the same. So the pie is the same. So to your point, it's a very competitive world. The good news is the pie doesn't shrink too badly, too strongly. So it's still the same pie, but nevertheless, it's competitive. So how do you keep or increase your part of the pie is you've got to be competitive. You find better ideas than your competition, and you have to protect them. So to your point, Ralph, is our strategy at TaylorMade was really to hire great, great, brilliant engineers and then invest in the design of product in a significant way in order to deliver great performance. And of course, you can, as I started to talk to you about, if you just go from an intellectual or mechanical approach, you it's not enough. By being connected to the best golfers and testing our ideas with them, we really can imagine and sense what's meaningful for them and how to deliver and choose. Because you have so many things you can do, but they're not all making sense. And it's the one that really are the most meaningful that really resonate with golfers. And that's how you win the competition.
It just popped in my head, the fact that you also had developed, back in the 2000s, you developed the MAT system, which allowed you to analyze how everything was working together. So it's not only just building golf balls, building golf clubs, but building a way to really understand and measure how they're performing.
Yeah, I often describe the work of research and development as you design, you make, you test. And so what you're referring to is the testing part of it, which is if you want to understand performance in golf, you need to develop really very accurate and performing testing equipment. And so the one you mentioned, the MAT system, allowed us to analyze the swing. How golfers were presenting golf clubs, at impact, and how they manipulate their product. The closest that, as I used to describe that, the closest the product is to the hand of the golfer, and the more the golfer plays a role. So the grip, the shaft are more in. They need to fit the golfer. There is an attunement that needs to be really taken care of here versus the golf ball. The golf ball has more mechanical behavior. It's away from the hand of the golfer. So, yes, we spend tremendous energy to understand how golfers were swinging. And we did that with all categories of golfers for years, millions and millions of swings, in order to understand what to do and how to design equipment better.
Again, it just pops in my head as I think back to your first job was designing shaft for clubs. And now that's widely another company entirely. that's designing their shafts and you're building clubs to work with them, fitting different golfers. But the whole idea of a shaft coming from the club maker is, that's long since gone.
What's really gone is this idea of the club designers manufacturing the shaft ourselves. We always design our shafts with our partners, vendors in golf who are specializing in carbon fibers, graphite manufacturing processes. So we always design with our partners, but we believed at some point in our life that we could make those parts ourselves. And that's the idea that we entertained for a while, and we went back and we reverted back to, no, let's just design with them. The manufacturing portion will be in the hand of our partner. In golf ball, it's different. In golf ball, we're doing a mixed model where we make our high-end golf balls and some our partners are making some other part of the golf balls, some other golf balls in the line of products. So different strategy, but it was the design stayed in the hand of the TaylorMade R&D department.
As chief technical officer, how would your position relate with everyone else in design? Obviously, you're at the top of that ladder, but it's not just a boss. I imagine you had to be a mentor, a coach, but also an administrator. All those things wrapped up, but do you think you tended in one direction or another in terms of how you worked with the team over the course of developing product?
Initially, I was when the team was small in the early 2000s. I was very involved technically with the design of the product directly, and then as the team grew, my role changed dramatically. To your point, Ralph. I became more an administrator of a large department of engineers. And what does it mean? Does it mean that I was pushing paperwork around? Absolutely not. I think that there was not a day where I was not reviewing a large numbers of technical reports or discussing or being in meeting to talk about. But at this point, I was more looking at the design from just the report point of view, which is I saw what's going to be designed, I saw testing reports, and we would discuss directions. So I was not involved in designing myself or testing myself anymore. But I still had, up to my latest days, some fun days with the robots. I still wanted to see firsthand how a golf club would perform, or I would go to see a player test. Being run, when I look at my role at the end, it was mainly to make sure that I had a team that could work in a way that it would constantly deliver innovation consistently, and that was the word, because you know, you can do that one day, one time, one year. It's easy to have a one-time shot of being great. What's really hard is to do that every year, 15, 20 years in a row. So I was consumed more to make sure that I was hiring, training, and managing people in the way that they were developing, they were growing, in the way they were expressing themselves, and they had the freedom to really innovate in this department. And those words seem simple, but you know, to constantly seek how to express, to have every engineer express their talent, was a daily for me, a daily preoccupation. At the end of it, I think my best reward on earth is the fact that my successor is someone that was in the team. We didn't have to seek for someone outside the team to do that. And then more to it, the team is still there together without me, deliver consistently performance and innovation, which proved that I think I left behind a great culture
Well, it's funny you say that, literally that word, because the next thing I was going to point out was you were considered a cultural leader there within the company, not just in design, but I mean, overall, you were ahead of the culture.
Thanks. Those are nice words on your part, Ralph. What I think I stayed true to was, I would say, very, very few simple things. First, true innovation. I was true to that. So I was very instrumental on fostering advanced development, which is what are we going to do in 2, 3, 4 years? How did I do that? I make sure that we had resources dedicated for the future, not only dedicated for the product to develop tomorrow. It's an internal battle to say, yes, we're going to hire this engineer and he's not going to be consumed for what we have to design this year. No, we have a big problem on the product we have to launch. It's okay. We're not going to pull that engineer in. He is busy with 2, 3 years out. So I can tell you that those are internal battles that are interesting. But so I stay true to that. I stayed true to collaboration all these years. I think an employee would be always valued for his technical competence, but also for his ability to work with others. And I think I put training in place every year. I put all these engineers in massive amount of training on personal skill set in order to work with each other, to have languages, to deal with their differences, with their difficulties to collaborate, because that was important. So that I was true. And then, of course, there was maybe you've heard about it. There was one of my pep, I would say, the personal development that I've fostered over the years, which is what we call coaching. So I developed a culture where peers could coach other people into the company. Like this, they had someone safe to speak to. About how to be a better person. And that was also a part of the culture.
One item you and I talked about many years ago was the idea of essentially turning golf on its head, ignoring the rules, and creating golf clubs that had some performance characteristics, but they were built for true beginners. Whether they were children or even adults, these were like adult-sized toy clubs. And I know that the ability to grow the game using technology was something that really meant a lot to you.
Yeah, it's true that you hear me often talk about the best players in the world. And then what about the rest? and what we've learned is that those technologies that we develop for the best, there is always an application, always a way to use those inventions to enhance the game of every golfer, children, beginners, confirmed golfers, whatever level you have, and whatever where you are on your personal development. I think we have not maybe pushed that idea as far as I wished with maybe children. Then what we've done with maybe more adult, if there is something that in my past I wish we had done more, that would be one area. But I think once you turn, you know, a teenager to an old adult, I think we've covered the needs for many, many, many golfers.
One of the ideas was, look, let's just have courses that have bigger holes so that it's easier to make putts. Let's make the game more easy for those that are trying to get into it so that they can really become hooked and addicted like we all are.
Yeah, we try to promote some of those revolutionary ideas, to your point. We try to open golf to some other avenues. We see some applications of that here and there. Soccer golf, I think, is one of those. That
foot golf, yes.
Foot golf, yeah, I think it's called, yeah. That frisbee golf is something also that take off. It's actually bringing people to a place that was exclusively reserved to only golfers. I think having some people who've never played golf, bringing them to this field is and enjoying the environment and what it feels to be on those holes in another way. I think that that's one way to open the game of golf, not only just playing, but being in the environment of a golf course.
In 2017, it was announced that you were going to retire from TaylorMade, and you said to me, "Well, Ralph, I'm going to go back to school." I thought you were kidding. You know, maybe you're going to go and pursue something fun, light, just enjoy yourself. No, you went headfirst into an entirely new career.
Yeah, yeah. I now know what it feels like to do what I decided to do back then. 2017 was interesting year in my life. When I say, okay, I'm at the peak of my golf career. I know what to do. I have a great intuition. I know how to lead a fabulous team. And then, you know, who quits when you are like that? Usually, you know, you leave when it you kind of go down a little bit and, you know, you start it. No, I quit when I was at my best. And that was, I can tell you, it's easy to say. It's a little harder to do. I do remember pushing my carts with all my boxes for my office and at 6 o'clock one night when nobody was there. And it was hard. Let's put it this way. To load my car with all these boxes was a hard moment in my life. To leave behind me, you know, what I've loved for 30 years. But what I've discovered since I went back to school to get a master in family therapy, master degree, it's one of those degrees that you only have to do a master. You don't have to do a PsyD or PhD again and to obtain a license in the state of California and to be able to be a therapist. And so that's the route I took, went back to school, you know, sat down, got grounded sometimes because I, you know, didn't turn my paper on time or arrive 5 minutes late. I lived the life of a student. I got points off of my essay because I was maybe a little too strong with the teacher in one of my comments one time. I don't even remember. So I lived the life of a real student, wrote a lot of paper, read a lot of documents, took exams. And then, you know, 3 years later, I just graduated last year with my master. It was the COVID year. So like many, many students in the United States, I was deprived from this huge reward that actually all students deserve when they accomplish the work they accomplish. I felt, of course, I felt less frustrated because it was not my first degree. I already had my reward in the past, but I really was feeling for all these students that, like me, couldn't enjoy the real party. Nevertheless, graduated, and then I'm in the field every day. I'm speaking to clients, and it's a wonderful life.
Talk about how much that work fulfills what had been a lifelong passion. I mean, you talk about you achieve so much in golf and technical, mechanical and innovation, but now you get to go into this totally different direction, still help people in a totally different way.
Yeah, it is, and it's not a real departure because, as you've heard me saying, as the last 10 years of my life at TaylorMade, I was managing a large team of people, so I was dealing with more understanding how to grow every employee and how to put them in the best job, in the best task, best project, in order to help them grow and express themselves. And so I was already, you know, spending way much more time and thinking about people than really designing product. And that was as somehow a natural transition for me to say, okay, let's just forget the technical side and spend my whole time with just people to see how to help them, you know, improve their lives and make better choices for themselves and make choices that they would not, maybe they would hesitate to do otherwise because they would be in the grip of old patterns and fears. And so it's what I discovered in this job is I'm kind of doing a little bit the same as far as promoting finding better ways to live your life. Now, I wouldn't hide for you that the people that I speak to now, they may come at the beginning of their journey with me with more suffering, more psychic suffering than the employees that I was working with, for many reasons, historical reason in their lives. And so there's more work to do. But that's the reason why I'm doing that, 100% of my time.
In your years in the industry, expose you to so many different unique business practices. You talked about you practically had to have a law degree at this point because of all the different things you've done and the coaching of the people. You've been a professional coach for a number of years before this, just trying to help people find their way forward in business.
Yeah, it is true. Yeah, it is true that you reminded me that I've been practicing business coaching for many years as well. So that was a great preparation also for the jump. And to your point is everyone is trying to find not only the project of his or her life, but also at work, they're trying to find the best business model, the best way to work together as a team, the best organization. And so that's maybe one of the way I stayed engaged with my previous position, which is in my business coaching activity, where actually I meet a lot of leaders who are trying to perfect the way they work and the environment they create. And it's amazing how really when you hear over and over and over that an organization is pretty much as good as their leaders. Because it starts right there. I know we hired a lot of talented employees, but you can create very different cultures depending on the leaders. I always use the analogy of an orchestra. The conductor doesn't play any instrument, but the symphony can really sound very different depending on the conductor.
We always wrap up our talks here on The Range by jumping into the Wayback Machine. And honestly, if there actually was a time machine, the only person I know who might have invented it is you. So, but as we go back, we look at your club portfolio. And is there a model or two that jump out because of either their technical innovation or just a personal fondness that you hold for them?
My preferred product is always an interesting question. You know, the problem we have is the latest one is so good.
Well, that's normally when I'm talking with people that are actively designing, I say you can't talk about the latest. It's about what means the most to you in your heart. Like, you know, when you think of a club, I know that there's already one that popped in your head that it's like, that one was always special to me. And it's not maybe the best performing club, but there's a reason it meant so much.
Yeah, of course. No, I think that, and you pointed out during your questions, the R7 was a massive turn in everything. It was a huge technical leapfrog. I mean, it was like we had lead tape for 100 years, and suddenly we could do the same thing in a way, much more efficient way. So it was such a technology breakthrough that lasts for so long. There was another reason, is because it was also it solved so many problems we had. Imagine when our employees were fitting a tour player on a weekly basis, they would leave them with five drivers, let them test it during the week, come back the week after and hear the comments and try to give them five more drivers, balance differently. And then they would do that for months. Mm-hmm. And then to do the exact same thing, it would take us 15, 20 minutes on a range. I mean, it was... Not only it was a design revolution, but the what we could do for those best players in such a time, in such an efficient way, was a dramatic departure from all the practices we've done for the previous 30 or 40 years of our lives. And of course, we did the same thing with all the golfers in the world. But it started at the tour level to show it its value. And then finally, it's when we really took off, we beat our competition. We regained our number one position. I'm always a little, hesitant to go out, speak about our wartime, But, you know, number one, number two, number three, you try to be number one in your field. And I think that that's when we regain our number one position as a driver company, a company who's selling driver. And then, of course, as a company in making golf clubs. It was a massive moment in my life when I joined TaylorMade in 89. We were number one in golf, and we lost that position the first 15 years of my life with TaylorMade. And, you know, it doesn't feel good to lose what you gained so hardly and what you joined the company for. And I was so proud that 15 years later, going down, losing that ground, we regained that position. We, you know, after all, we love to be on the podium. You don't want to be on the third. You want to be on the first one. And that's natural. That felt really good.
Well, when you told me you were retiring back in 2017, I worked feverishly to get an interview scheduled to talk about your amazing career. And sadly, that never came to pass. So literally, this talk has been in production in my brain for 4 years. So you've had an amazing career in golf. Even more important is what you're doing now in therapy and counseling. I'm sure you know how much the latter helps people. I mean, you see that. But I hope you realize how many millions of folks you've touched over the years with your mechanical genius. And I want to thank you for all those years, and thanks for joining us here on the range.
Thank you for having me, Rob. It was such a pleasure.
That was Dr. Benoit Vincent, and truly, I have enjoyed so many wonderful talks with him, both in formal settings or just as a matter of simple side conversation. His passion for his work was always evident, and when he told me he was retiring, I could see just as much excitement as he talked about this next venture as I would see when he introduced a brand new driver. Imagine entering into the world of golf, having never swung a club, and building a team, an operation that would dominate the golf equipment world. Movable weight technology, mastering multi-layer golf ball production, evolving into shaft customization. His work and leadership has truly led to the equipment that we play now. It's easy to forget how far technology has come in the last 15 to 20 years. So instead, let's celebrate the many people like Dr. Benoit Vincent who have helped it advance along its journey. And now the doctor's done it again, committing to helping people in their everyday lives. He's just an amazing man, and I'm so fortunate to have known him over the years. And I'm also glad that I could share this talk with you all. Of course, we continue to share what's new in golf equipment, and you can learn all about that with the Golf Spotlight. We are dropping new features all the time, looking at clubs, accessories, footwear, and more. Go to thegolfspotlight.com, click on the YouTube subscribe button, and turn on those notifications so you never miss one of our features. There is a lot to catch up on. Stay up to date on the range by following us on Instagram at thegolfspotlight. We're also on Twitter at Golf Spotlight. We welcome your comments everywhere. You've listened this far, so subscribe to The Range on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify or iHeart. We have new shows dropping every Wednesday. That will do it for this episode of The Range, so let's hit the course and appreciate all the genius that went into every club, ball, bag, glove, and shoe that you use every round. And to honor those geniuses, why don't you engineer some amazing play out there? And we'll talk to you next time, right here on The Range.